101, a version 1 podcast.
Welcome to the 101 podcast, conversations about technology and innovation with some of the UK and Ireland's leaders and trailblazers. My name is Peter Gothard, and today I'm joined by Peter Bebbington, one of the founders of Brainpool AI. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
So if I just jump straight in, really, what is Brainpool AI?
So Brainpool AI, in its core, is a network of extremely talented researchers and freelancers. We have around 400 now. We've sort of grown that from the initial Brainpool, which was around 40. And we leveraged a pool as a consultancy.
Okay. So you're organized as a consultancy. The people who work for you, they work as freelancers, contractors.
Correct, yes. Yeah.
So essentially you're pulling together all the finest minds to solve, I guess, some of the biggest problems.
Yeah, exactly. So some of the people that we have in the pool are from some of the most prestigious AI and machine learning research organizations. So we sort of enjoy or benefit from the fact that the people that work with us in a temporary fashion. And you know, that allows them to go back to their parent organizations and stay ahead of a very fast-moving research topic, which is machine learning.
Which I think is very important at the point we're kind of at now. Yeah. with AI and machine learning. I think we maybe past the hype phase, and now we're actually at the point where people want to be getting something realistic out of it on a project level.
Yep. So one of the most common difficulties for companies at the moment entering machine learning or trying to use machine learning is the deployment aspect, because you know these models, they're not static, data's not static. You have to be constantly retrained, redeployed, and so you have to have very complicated infrastructures to deploy them and manage them in production. And that technology is only, in my opinion, starting to catch up to how people want to use this in production.
Sure. And in terms of the technology, you've got your people going into organizations to, help them build projects and build models and build, ways of doing things. Are your experts using the technology that's in place at organizations or taking their own, or how do they work with technology?
Well, it can be a real mixed bag, depending on the legacy systems that a lot of companies work with, especially in the finance sector. But there seems to be more of a focus now towards microservices. Mm. And the reason for this, it's much easier to manage in an operational sense and resource microservices than the sort of monolithic approach of the last decade. So, when it comes to, say, prototyping models, a very popular tool is Python. And then for more production focus, so i.e. sort of a lower latency, lower level languages, things like C++, Go are very, very popular. But I think in terms of the technologies themselves that are used, it doesn't really matter. It's just like, you speak one language, you speak another. Mm. I think what is more important is how software is delivered and also how it's deployed. So any software that we build, we abide by the protocols of the company who is basically contracting and commissioning us to create the software. So we tend to containerize a lot of our software. So then once that's been containerized, then the client can integrate that into their own infrastructure, be that on cloud or be that on-premise.
Brilliant. So essentially you can, build everything in a contained sort of testable environment, and then they can deploy it ad hoc, sort of in not a complete fashion, but in a usable fashion, mm-hmm. as and when they like. And that I guess then your involvement can start to lessen, perhaps, as that project's
finished. Yeah, it could even increase more in terms of helping our clients understand how to best deploy these technologies, so what type of infrastructures to use. And some companies want to be very agnostic when it comes to infrastructure, and others want to just rely on maybe one particular cloud provider, or just have everything on-prem. So we're philosophy is more in a sort of agnostic space. So I like to work with Kubernetes, which, you know, allows one to, you know, deploy any type of container and manage that in a very flexible way.
Great. You mentioned a little earlier on that there used to be a bit more of an kind of academic focus. So I'm wondering now about the founding of this company, really, and where you came from. I'm wondering, maybe, is there an academic background? Was this done at university, or what's the history?
Yeah, so it was spun out of UCL, which we're not too far away now, so a little bit nostalgic. but I did a PhD in physics at UCL. But my funding came from the computer science department, and in particular, financial computing group within UCL. And so I was exposed to a lot of talented researchers working on the frontiers of machine learning and artificial intelligence. And so myself and my co-founders also had very similar backgrounds to myself. Sort of saw that there was a demand for the knowledge that our colleagues at our respective universities had. And so we sort of thought, well, why don't we try and turn this into a company?
And sorry, when was that? What sort of period are we talking?
It's, I guess, 2016, 2017.
Okay, so yeah, you were right in the middle of I guess checking the hype cycle and thinking, mm-hmm. how can this actually start to be, as it's already said, implemented and
You know, it did. You know, I was very much a physicist, so to me, when I was looking at a lot of the machine learning research guys, I was sort of like, it just seemed like a little bit of a bandwagon. But then when I actually started using the technologies myself and seeing how useful they are to solve problems, especially data analytics problems, you know, I could see the real value. And then, you know, seeing some of the demonstrations of some of the researchers at the computer science department in terms of machine vision, you know, very much, you know, still in its infancy then, you know, it's come a long, long way since then. But it was still very interesting to sort of observe the power of a computer recognizing objects without any real human intervention.
And with a background, I guess, as a physicist, was it the sort of real world and physical application of this sort of technology, which is that kind of what attracted you?
I guess I've always enjoyed working with numbers. So I enjoy mathematics. But I also enjoy using computers to help me solve problems that I can't solve by hand or chalk. So, you know, I think machine learning has been used in a variety of different problems within physics. So, for example, in cosmology and astrophysics, they've used it, actually in the UCL department too, they've used machine vision technology to help count galaxies, which, you know, may seem like an arbitrary, not a very useful application of the technology. But if you can imagine a human by hand, you know, trying to count galaxies or stars, it's quite a difficult task. And so, you know, machines and sort of machine vision technology are very, very good at performing tasks like that.
Mm. Which, I guess, if you open that out to the whole of, you know, worldly needs and problems, it's almost like the sky's the limit, which I guess actually gets me asking, really, if we can talk about a few of the kind of implementations of what you guys are doing that now do exist kind of in the wider business environment. And maybe if you can talk a bit about just stuff you've done or are doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess to give everyone a little bit of background, so Brainpool does operate as a consultancy, and, you know, we work with various different clients within finance and also fintech, and our technology gets used predominantly by the financial clients to make forecasts. So that's something that my background, I have a lot of experience in creating forecasting algorithms. And then also on the other side of the business, we have a sort of product focus. So we try to use the Brainpool platform as a sort of, I guess, an R&D platform to help us to sort of figure out how we can productize this technology. And we use the consultancy platform to help us identify what should be productized instead of just creating a product and hoping there would be a market for it. So we look at the sort of the needs and wants of our clients who may be interested in particular APIs instead of building things in-house. And then we productize with respect to that. And I think a great example of this is another venture that we're working on within the construction space called Daisy AI.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a bit more about that then.
Sure. So Daisy AI came through a partnership or more so a collaboration between a large UK-based construction company. What those guys do is they build in a sort of very prefabricated way. They build timber floors and also staircases. And currently, that process of designing, say a floor plan is there's a lot of human interaction in that process, and there's a lot of bottlenecks because of that. Mm. So the process at the moment would be that, a building contractor or a developer approaches our client, our partner, and they are requested to give a quote. So what happens then is they sort of get the specifications from the client, and then those specifications go to the architectural department, which they have, I believe, around 10 architects. And so what they'll get is a series of, say, shapes and dimensions and potentially regulations that the particular buildings have to adhere to or abide by. And then the architect has to basically draw those out using, say, something like AutoCAD. Mm. And so lots of the elements within those designs are quite sort of tedious and mundane, and sort of quite repetitive tasks, which in truth a very highly trained architect shouldn't be doing. And also it takes a lot of time. And so one of the particular tasks that the architects have to do is basically draw out how the floor beams and joists are distributed across the floor plan, to stop you falling from the floor. And so that takes a lot of time. And so if our clients wanted to, say, double their production, I think at the moment they're doing around 400 floors a week, they would have to basically hire or double their workforce, which is not a scalable solution. So this is where Daisy comes in, and Daisy automates those tasks, and it does it in a way that is comparable in terms of the costing, or sometimes it comes out cheaper than what a human architect would design in terms of how the joists and beams are distributed. And also, it also checks heuristics like integrity and any sort of regulations that the floor has to abide by. So they're also inputted into our algorithm.
So just for clarity here, because I feel like we're touching onto one of these areas where an architect, in a way, I guess, is an artist and an engineer, mm-hmm. in combination. So are we looking at sort of the AI is picking up after, say, the architect has done the creative bit, which makes the very unique, wonderful looking place where somebody wants to live because it looks really cool? They're going to keep working with that plan, but make it almost do the hidden technical parts which make the building viable. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just also wondering, does the AI ever start an argument with the architect and say, well, this blue sky thinking you've had is not going to work, and I'm going to change the shape of the floor or the ceiling or the angle, or and is there a to and fro situation then?
Well, it's very restrictive in that manner. I guess maybe in terms of how it's currently getting developed at the moment, in terms of the designs that we create are still getting checked by a human architect. So there still is a human in the loop. Per se, but now what the architects can do is that, say they've got 10 jobs that need to be, 10 designs that need to be designed, mm-hmm. They can just basically load those as a batch job and then leave them for however long it takes, maybe overnight or, you know, maybe a few hours. And then all those designs are completed. And then, yes, they can look at the designs and then determine whether, you know, is this within the realms of the of sort of the reality of a human doing it? Is it comparable? And so far, yes, we can achieve results that are cheaper, because what we're actually doing is, so a human architect would sort of, they'll have their own sort of ad hoc heuristics to sort of understand how much a particular floor plan would cost, and how, you know, little tricks to you know, make it as cost effective as possible, but they're not really doing anything analytic. So this is what we do in terms of the sort of optimization process, where we're actually checking that over time, as we're iterating through all of the different designs, we're reducing the cost till we come to a point where we can't really reduce it as that much anymore. Mm. And so to do that, we use an evolutionary algorithm, or the genetic program, as it's also known. And so that allows us to incorporate randomness into the designs, but be able to keep the best features which lead to the floor plan or the floor design with the lowest cost.
Sounds you know, really, really promising. I mean, I've got some stats here, maybe just to remind everyone, but the global market cap of the construction industry is $10 trillion, and that's 10% of the UK economy alone is in the construction trade. The growth, apparently, between 2018 and 2023, we're looking at 407.2 million in 2018 to 1,831 million, in fact, by 2023. So that's the compound annual growth rate of 35.1%. And then the UK government, in order to meet its housing target, has to essentially recruit one worker every 77 seconds. So, I mean, obviously, I'm not asking you to calculate, you know, how you could tackle those stats, but that one worker every 77 seconds, could your algorithm or your technology sort of make a dent into that then? Is that the belief?
Well, for the floor plan optimization, which we discussed before, we're not trying to replace anyone. We're just trying to make people's and workers in the construction sector, their lives easier and more productive. So in the particular example of the floor plan optimization, we basically want to take all of the tasks that take a long time for an architect to do and automate them. Mm. And this is something what we, you know, would, when we work with our partner, we are sort of trying to find those bottlenecks in the way they operate. And these bottlenecks are sort of quite universal, because the construction sector is probably, comparative to other sectors, the biggest laggard when it comes to adopting technology. Mm. Things haven't really changed too much over the last 50 years, according to our partners. So we just want to make things more efficient. That's the general aim. And, you know, with greater efficiency means greater productivity, and therefore means more buildings will get built quicker and cost effective,
which is essentially what we desperately need. So
yes, yeah.
Yeah, I see that. In terms of growing the pool, I suppose one thing that interests me as well, there's a constant sort of talk of skills gaps in all of these data based and data led areas. Are there sort of certain people that you're looking for now to grow the pool that represent any kind of general gap in skills that organizations may be experiencing? Mm-hmm.
Across the board. So, you know, I think talented scientists and computer scientists are hard to come by. I think talented data scientists are very hard to come by. And I think also one of the other, and we're actually in the process of trying to recruit one ourselves, are data engineers. And when I mean data engineers, like, I mean, you know, the creme de la creme of data engineers, where, you know, these guys know how to build data pipelines that can handle large data volumes. So I guess those sort of, was that three that I named? I think data science, computer scientists, and data engineers, yeah. Yes. So I think those are the biggest skill gaps at the moment, in my opinion.
Okay, thank you for that. And I just wondered, and this may be an incredibly broad question, so just slap me on the head if I'm wrong here, but do you have any sort of general tips for companies that may be looking to start doing AI projects, you know, in-house, apart from just hiring you, which obviously would be a great idea. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that aside, just almost some top tips of how to just sit down and start achieving something.
Yeah, well, I think the first place, and a lot of companies are doing this now, is upskilling your current workforce. Mm. And, you know, I think that not only sort of has a value add for the businesses because they're getting a lot of skills, but it's also a very motivational, it's very motivating for someone who has maybe a technical background to be able to learn new skills and new technologies to use. So, you know, there's also that benefit. And then, you know, the thing about machine learning, especially sort of right now, it's so quick, and you know, it's almost like a moving target. So, you know, you learn one approach or one implementation, and then, you know, a couple of weeks later it's like, well, this new one's come in, and it gives you 5% better than the one before. So I think what companies, and you know, companies do this, I think there's this sort of continuous learning and upskilling of workforces, I think, will help. And also, once they have learned the jargon and the intuition behind the subject, then they can sort of go, they can start asking relevant questions about operations currently in the business and go, okay, well, maybe we can solve this bottleneck by introducing this particular type of machine learning algorithm, which will automate 80% of the process.
That's good advice, definitely. Thank you very much. Well, it seems like, you know, everything's still to play for, really, in AI machine learning. And it's great that companies like yours are really organising yourselves to sort of fan out and really start to help people achieve more results. I think that's about all we've got time for today. So my name is Peter Gothard. This has been the 101 podcast. I was joined by Peter Bebbington, one of the founders of BrainPool AI. Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
And thank you all for listening, and see you all again soon. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the 101 podcast. If you would like more information about any of our podcasts or our guests, visit us at version1.com/1-0-1.